What I'd like to do is summarize some of the things that I've been involved with over the last several years as far as research programs at Colorado State University and some of the interactions that are existing and potential for public-private collaborations. I thought I would start just by showing this graph that kind of indicates what we're facing in any type of research program where there's an initial investment that has to be made in order to generate the basic information, the background knowledge that's needed. And typically, this is the component that is conducted by the public sector, universities, other research institutes, and so forth, because during this phase, it's really a cost. It's an investment in future returns, and there may or may not be something that can be commercializable or profit-generating at some point in the future. But over the long haul, those investments in research will result in profit when commercialization occurs. And I think some of the investments that NSF made with the programs at NASA and some other places are good examples of some of the positive returns that can come out. I think this is also really critical when you look at the funding environment that we're in, especially from some of the federal agencies where there's a lot of focus on short-term research projects. In other words, it's very difficult to see where those can result in significant returns. So is that with a backdrop? What I'd like to do is cover several items that Vern mentioned in his introduction, kind of recap again what the trends are as far as publicly funded research, talk a little bit about what the characteristics are of those programs. What I've observed in some of the considerations as we look at public-private collaborations, and then just a couple comments on the kind of relationships that can exist as we look at public-private opportunities. This is a graph that has been put together from a number of sources looking at the distribution of funding for agricultural research. And this is broad-based ag research. This would include livestock systems, cropping systems, et cetera. Up until the early 80s, the public sector was the major source of funding for those programs, but since the early 80s, the private sector is actually investing a lot more in agricultural research programs than is coming from the public sector. And the public sector would include both the federal and the state components. And you can see by the slope of those lines that the private sector is actually increasing quite a bit faster than the public sector. So as we look at the last couple decades, a lot of the investment is coming from the private sector. If we look at public sector support, state support for agricultural research has exceeded the federal investment for many years, and it was also increasing at a level that was in excess of federal funding. And as Vern mentioned, one of the critical things that's happened in the last few years is that the downturn in the economy has had a real serious impact on state funding for all of our institutions, especially land-grant universities. And just using CSU as an example, we have reduced funding in our Ag Experiment Station by over 30% since about 2003. And so as a result of those reductions, we've had to close research centers. There's been layoffs of staff. We've been able to maintain faculty. But obviously, if you have a 30% reduction in funding, you don't have the support staff, you don't have the operating dollars, and so forth. And so those reductions have impacted some of the programs that we've got. If we look at the federal funding, and the majority of us have looked at USDA as being the major source of funding for agricultural research programs, basically there's two types of funding within that pot, actually three. The formula funds come out to all of the land grants that provide basically capacity or infrastructure for what we're doing. And towards the bottom of that, you'll see the green line, which indicates the competitive grants, and those have been increasing significantly since the programs were initiated back in the late 70s. I think another important factor to incorporate here is the view of the broader scientific community, as well as a number of agencies in Washington, on the relative merits of the formula funds that go to our land grant programs as opposed to competitive grants. The Office of Science Technology plus Office of Management and Budget really favor competitive grants because there's a feeling that the best quality science is conducted by having an open competitive process for allocation of those resources. And the science establishment in general supports that general approach for allocating resources. There's significant costs associated with that. I put this slide together to kind of contrast what the advantages are of having funds come to our programs through a formula basis, which I'd really prefer to refer to as capacity or infrastructure funds rather than formula, and then contrast that with programs that are funded through contracts and grants. And one of the critical things is, where are the priorities set for those different programs? The formula funds come to the states, and I, as a director of the experiment station, can make decisions as to where those funds are going to go. If you, in the competitive grant arena, it's really an RFA plus priorities that are set by the funding agencies. So the contrast is having priorities set at the state level versus priorities set in Washington, D.C. The types of topics that are covered with formula funds, we can do long-term research, things like developing new crop varieties, tillage studies, crop rotations, etc. The majority of the competitive grants tend to be short-term, 2 to 3 years. There's been a move now to go to a 5-year program in some cases, but the norm is still the 2 to 3. In order to respond to state needs, the formula type funding is more appropriate. The cost associated with distributing those funds is significantly less through the formula approach than it is through competitive grants. Faculty spend a significant amount of time developing proposals. There's peer review panels that are put together to review those proposals. And when you consider only 10 to 15% of the proposals get funded, there's a really great investment of time and effort by a lot of people in order to allocate those funds. So there's cost savings there. We also have got an agricultural system that's national in scope, and it's important that we have ag research programs existing in all the production regions across the state, whether it be a major crop or a minor crop. The ongoing funding in the states can support that, as opposed to competitive grants, which really favor the institutions that have greater public support from their states, as well as larger faculties and so forth. Return on investment, there's been a number of studies that show that greater than 50% return is common on some of the formula-funded programs, and there's also a significant return on the competitive grant research, but the costs are significantly higher. There has also been a study that was conducted by economists at Iowa State looking at if we shifted all of the formula funds into competitive grants, what would be the impact on the various states across the country? And I think you could predict that the real gainers are those states that have the largest universities, the largest land grants, and the ones that are the most competitive for contract and grants from a number of sources. And that could be a variety of state agencies. So the biggest gainers are California, Florida, New York, some of the Big Ten schools, and so forth. And the biggest losers are going to be some of the states that have smaller land grants and just do not have the capacity to be competitive for a lot of those large grant programs. So in order to maintain a stable national ag research system in the public sector, it's important to have both the formula funding plus a competitive grant type of program. But to me, the bigger problem in public funding is just where USDA fits in the overall federal scheme of things as far as priorities for research funding. The National Institutes of Health a few years ago started a campaign to increase budget, and the goal was to cure cancer. And that's something that everybody can relate to. And I think within agriculture, we tend to be dispersed. There's a lot of diverse interests, and it's difficult for us to get behind one major topic, and all of us go to Washington and support that. And so USDA funding has lagged way, way behind. As you can see, it's way down at the bottom, and the proportion of the federal R&D budget going to agriculture has not shifted much over the last 30 years. NSF, NASA, and some other agencies have fared better than USDA. One of the most disappointing things for me was when we had the stimulus money a few years ago, NIH got like $10 billion and USDA got zero. And so it was a real lost opportunity as far as being able to enhance some of our programs. So, and this is just kind of a summary as to where all the support comes from for our publicly supported ag research programs. I also put USDA in there as far as a component, because for many of us, USDA is an extremely critical local partner. They support many, many collaborative research projects, and in many land grants, there's actually ARS scientists that are located within the departments as well. The other thing I would point out is that within the last budget process, there was a lot of discussion about earmarks, and so the earmarks got eliminated, and within the USDA budget, that was over $80 million of earmarks, and I know a number of states had ongoing programs that were supported by those earmarks, and although there's a perception that they're lower quality, I know the ones that I'm familiar with, they're basically integrated into the overall portfolio that we have and contribute to very strong ongoing programs and provided some very useful funding for those activities. Let me just make a few comments about some of the characteristics of public programs. Just draw your attention to the statement there at the bottom. If society were to rely on the private sector alone to fund R&D, many socially beneficial research projects would not be undertaken. This is especially true for basic research projects, and that's probably as critical for agriculture as it is for medicine or anything else. So the types of programs that we tend to focus on in the public sector, obviously basic research is a real critical one. Fundamental knowledge is required to address a lot of needs. We also have a lot of applied research, and many of our agronomy departments are involved in that. And I think the important thing to realize is that agriculture is place-based. In other words, a solution to a problem on corn production in Iowa may not be the same solution that you would apply in eastern Colorado. And so it's important that we have this national distributed system. And I think the other major role that is supported by the research programs that we have is that it contributes to education of students at the undergraduate level, the graduate level, and it's going to be an important way of filling the pipeline. Just a couple of examples on some of the areas where there's really very little support that we can expect from the private sector, and where public research funding is going to be increasingly important. There's a lot of issues that agriculture has to face where there's no real product involved, but there's a lot of issues that have to be addressed, things related to endangered species, climate change, environmental issues, ecosystem services, and so forth. I'd also point out the National Plant Germplasm System, which provides basically a resource of genetic material that can be used by a lot of programs, both public and private. There are also programs that we still have in the public sector that do result in a product, and it kind of depends on how the public and private sector programs have evolved over time. There are still commodities, crops that are dependent on public programs for developing new varieties. One of the programs I'm the closest involved with is the wheat program in the Great Plains. A number of land grants still provide the majority of wheat germplasm. Potatoes is another one, plus all of the many of the specialty crops. Crop production systems, models, software, and so forth are other things that come out of some of our programs that could be viewed as products. I'd like to shift gears and just talk about some of my observations as far as some of the considerations that need to be taken into account as we look at public-private partnerships. This is a diagram that I came across that kind of puts both public and private in the same context. We've got an infrastructure that we all deal with, facilities. There are laws, public acceptance, etc., for all of the different programs that we work with. Those feed in then to either a private R&D program or a public education one. The products that come out of that then need to meet the demand or a consumer, whether it be a producer, a student, a consumer, or whatever. And I think the critical thing is that we look at public-private, there's got to be a recognition of a research program that is based on a common interest between what we can provide in the public sector and also in the private sector. Some of the considerations that we always run into when we start having discussions with an entity about developing a public-private research program, the first one that comes up is intellectual property. And there's a couple of different components of that, how are materials shared, and I'll show one example of that. There's also always discussions on royalties, how are they collected, etc. There's issues on publication, which is especially important for a variety of programs that we have that involve both faculty and grad students. And then there's always the issues of funding. There's obviously direct costs that are associated with the program, but there's also a number of issues that come up with respect to indirect costs. Intellectual property. I think you're probably all as familiar with these as I am. There's been a real movement in the last couple decades on making some of these relationships more liberal. The Dole-Bayh Act in the 80s more or less asks us to commercialize things as they become available through our public programs. Issues on transfer of ownership, licensing agreement, and one of the things that we continually work with faculty on is understanding what the limitations are on disclosure as to when things can be shared publicly. We have a clientele that typically expects us to share things immediately, and sometimes when you have IP issues associated with a program, that policy needs to be modified or we need to change how we share some of the information. The real motivation for the university, in addition to short-term funding of programs, is also having some longer-term return on the investment through royalties. There needs to be an agreement as to what the basis is for those. And then at each institution, there's a policy that indicates how those royalty payments are going to be distributed to the various faculty and units that are involved in that particular program. And those policies, there's probably some general characteristics across the institutions, but every institution's probably got a little bit different view on some of those things. For example, at our institution, 35%, if you go through the standard royalty agreement process, 35% of the royalty comes back to the faculty member or the inventors of that particular royalty. Very little goes back to the program. Material transfer agreements are another thing that are becoming more and more prevalent amongst public institutions. I'm going to share one example that I've worked on for the last couple of years. In the wheat breeding program, There's been a wheat workers' code of ethics. It's been developed by the plant breeders. It's been in place for a number of years. It had no binding effect, but all the faculty pretty much agreed that this was the way that they wanted to work together and how they share germplasm. And with increasing interest from the private sector, there has been discussions at a number of institutions on taking this informal agreement and codifying it so that there is a better understanding between the public entities as to how material is going to be shared between the wheat breeding programs in a number of states. So we had an effort over the last couple of years to work with our wheat growers in a number of states, experiment stations, the breeders, our tech transfer staff at each university, and so we have put together an agreement on how we're going to share germplasm between Colorado State, Kansas State, Oklahoma State, and Texas A&M. And that has been made available to other institutions if they have an interest in using it. And this is something that we will use at CSU and how we share germplasm with other entities. Since we signed the agreement, Washington State, Oregon State, Idaho, and UC Davis have also said that they would like to sign on. So this is something that is going to continue to be an important topic as we look at the resources that are existing within the public sector that can be a component of agreements with various private institutions. Publications are another major component that has to be factored into these kinds of agreements. Our institution has got an absolute mandate that we have ability to publish the work. I mean, that's one of the main things that we do in higher education is to generate the knowledge and share it. But there can be delays in how fast things are published. It's especially critical if graduate students are involved. One of our panelists that'll be on the podium here later actually had this issue, I remember, back in the 70s when he was involved with his PhD program. There can be review and so forth by the partnership, but in the end, the PI really needs to make the final editorial decisions. We also have a lot of agreements with companies where we basically do some service type of work, and basically, for those agreements where there's not an absolute requirement for publication, we can actually do some cooperative work, and which is beneficial to both of us. 1 minute. I'm going to wrap this up real quick. Indirect cost is a major topic that comes up whenever we have discussions on a possible collaboration with a private sector firm. We have a rate at every institution that's negotiated with a federal agency. There are real costs associated with research, things like library facilities, all of the support. We have a fringe benefit program. We hire people. We purchase stuff. All of those things are activities that are covered within the indirect costs. But we have a real unwillingness amongst a number of partners to pay that thing. And if we don't have full recovery of the indirect, it's really a subsidy either by the university or the state for that particular research program. And basically every organization that we work with do have indirect costs. I heard an analogy the other day on the debate about indirect costs, and it goes something along the lines of, it's like trying to negotiate your travel reimbursement after you've spent the money. In other words, you've gone on the trip, you file your reimbursement, and then you argue about how you're going to get paid back. And so a couple of examples on how projects are funded, checkoffs, contracts, and grants, obviously licensing and ownership issues. Some of the areas where public-private projects are really important is really in the applied and production areas. Public plant breeding, I think, is going to be one of the major areas. It's going to be impossible for land-grant universities to develop new varieties with GM traits and some of the public programs without an industry partner. We do not have $30 to $40 million to get regulatory approval. So we're going to have partners there. There's issues in water quality, food safety. You probably read about listeria and cantaloupe It's a major issue in our state right now, and how do we address that? And I'll just say that the workforce pipeline can be a major component of the research activities that our public institutions. Endowments are a great way to do that, but for $1 million endowment at our institution generates $45,000 a year. That's basically one student. So when we talk about multi-million dollar endowments, although they're really significant, doesn't have as great an impact as we would hope. So decreasing public funding at both federal and state levels, the private funding is going to be increasingly important. There's a different mission between public and private, profit versus public good. We need to have clearly defined agreements ahead of time involving those things, but I think there's many areas where public and private can work together. So thank you.